Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Today's episode has been made possible through the generous support of Bright Peak Financial, an award-winning not-for-profit supporting Christians on their journey to financial strength. Go to brightpeakfinancial.com to make your dream happen.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today is the second in our series on the theme of religion and violence. And although we're focusing on religious aspects of violence, we're also looking at the endemic nature of violence in our society and the fact that ideologies and ways of thinking often influenced by our values and our religious systems, but they take on a life of their own. And we've been particularly musing in the last week on some of the events recently in our society in terms of police being targeted, and also, unfortunately, the slaying of people at traffic stops by police. And there are no easy answers to these things, but we've been exploring ways we can look at it in a more healthy way and more positively. Today, we're going to focus on I did a facetious title for the show, trying to lighten it up a little bit. When ideologies clash, who picks up the pieces? And so we'll look at that, what that means. And unfortunately, aggression, which is a natural thing, I think, in our human makeup, can lead into places that limit and confine and destroy. Joining me today is well-known Unity minister, Jim Gaither. Jim has served several Unity churches in his decades of service to Unity, as well as being a professor at Unity School for over 20 years. He's an adjunct professor at Holos University, and he currently serves as the Director of Academic and Student Affairs at Unity Worldwide Ministries, as Unity Worldwide Ministries takes on the educational function of the Unity movement, having had it passed from Unity World Headquarters or back to Unity Worldwide Ministries. And so there's a whole lot of work there, tooling that and making that successful. Endeavor, and we're pretty much moving to an online function rather than an residential, so that adds another nuance to that. Jim's also, but if anybody can do it, I think Jim's one of the people that could. He's also the author of books focusing on Charles Fillmore, co-founder of Unity, and on Jesus, and has published numerous articles in Unity Magazine and other outlets. So it's a joy to welcome Jim Gaither back to today's show. So welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for inviting me. It's always fun to talk to you, and it sounds like an interesting topic.
Yeah, you know, because we're talking about ideologies here, aren't we? You know, and in this presidential year where the campaigns, you know, seem so starkly opposed, ideologies are clashing. And I mentioned last week at the show that, and I mentioned it on my in my sermon last Sunday also, that you know, the power of words. If you want to know the power of words and how potent they are to build or to destroy, just take three words that that have been bandied about a lot lately, and that's Black Lives Matter. And depending on your worldview, your ideological approach, you'll hear totally different things from those three words. And that's unfortunate, because I think so often we don't understand what's really intended by certain words. We only understand it through the lens of our own perception. And who's going to pick up the pieces when we choose off from these divided ways of looking? So what's your take on that, Jim? Because I've sort of been asking, and I plan to ask our next guest too, what his take is on this phrase, this movement, Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, I actually believe I understand what the point of the phrase is, and I think it actually is fairly straightforward, but people mentally add their own words to it and shift the meaning somewhat. So, for example, I think some people hear it and say infer that what's being said is only Black Lives Matter, which it's not what it says. I believe the phrase came out of frustration, the feeling that in our society, or at least in certain segments of our society, a person's life matters less or not at all if they happen to be a person of color. And I know that there are people who have that attitude. I don't really think it's widespread in police departments, but it doesn't really take, it doesn't really take very many racist beliefs within a police department to create tragedy. I mean, yet when you have so many thousands of police persons, there's bound to be some who respond in ways that are, clearly not just and are based entirely on appearance. And I think the frustration of experiencing that is where the phrase comes from. Because, we're aware that people are, and this is just a fact, there's certain places where if a black person goes into a neighborhood in which black people are rarely seen, if a police officer sees them, they'll stop them, even if they're not doing anything. I mean, there's those kinds of little sort of indignities that are visited upon people based entirely on skin color. I mean, that still happens in America, and I don't know how widespread it is, but I know it's wide enough spread that, a lot of people either have experienced themselves or know someone who's experienced that sort of thing. So I think it comes out of that frustration. I think the intention of the movement is to try to establish greater fairness and justice in our society. And, of course, justice is a political value. It's also a spiritual value. In practically every spiritual tradition, there are ideas about justice in some form or another, whether it's in a theistic culture, it's the idea of God's justice, or whether it's more as in Indian religions, the idea of karma, a sort of principle that's always operative. To me, there's nothing at all suspect about the name of the movement or the intentions of it. And, in political terms, the Constitution guarantees the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition for redress of grievances and those sorts of things. So it's an exercise of constitutional rights. It's a longstanding American tradition. I think people's response to the phrase sort of indicates something about their mentality. Not necessarily that if they don't like the name, or if they respond to it by saying, well, all lives matter, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're prejudiced or racist, but it does sort of indicate that they're falling into the trap of thinking that what the phrase says is only Black Lives Matter, which isn't what it says.
Right, exactly.
If you're going to add anything to it, it would be the word "to" at the end. Black Lives Matter too. I think that's the mentality of the group, as far as I can tell. And again, they're exercising their rights to try to, change society in a positive direction.
And you mentioned
what it looks like to me, anyway.
Yeah, I think those are very sensible points you've made there, and I think there's times when a certain police officer may not even be racist, but the energy is such that there's fear and anxiety involved. So when the officer sees a black person, there's a profile going on, and there's a jump into conclusions, and so there's unwise behaviors happening, even if that particular person is not anti-black or whatever. So it's a double whammy. It's like once you get involved with the anxiety and the inherent fear here, that it sort of compounds itself, and so we have to stop that somehow, right? Like I said, a little bit facetiously came up with that title, when ideologies clash, who picks up the pieces. I think if I look at history, I tell myself that generally it's the ordinary people who pick up the pieces, right? It's after all the crazy, demagogues and destroyers of this culture or any culture, after they've done their work, then the ordinary folks have to be the ones that scoop up the mess and rebuild. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. The ordinary people are basically the ones who suffer the most during these,
Yes.
sort of massive egomaniacal attempts to control the world or conquer the world or whatever involving military action. I'd actually like to say a little bit about the current situation from the perspective of, what police have to do, because that's another thing I think that is widely misunderstood, because we see on the news the sort of aberrations of really bad police behavior because people happen to have a video camera with them or whatever. But one of the things to keep in mind is that the patrol officers, some of them are assigned to much more dangerous neighborhoods than others. The crime tends to, and this is sort of a sociological fact, that crime tends to be much higher in some areas, especially poverty-stricken areas, than others, which makes those areas more dangerous to work in for the police, generally speaking. And so they have to have a heightened sensitivity to danger, and that heightened sensitivity may, on occasion cause them to react in ways that they would regret if they could see it in retrospect. And that's, of course, part of the problem too. We're always seeing things in retrospect. We're not there in that position and seeing and experiencing what the officer is. So I don't think even all the cases where we see the sort of extreme cases of people being shot and that sort of thing, I don't think that's always fundamentally a matter of profiling. I think a lot of times it's just they're in a very dangerous neighborhood. They have a heightened sensitivity. They see something that in other situations has turned into a dangerous, situation. And so they react because they don't really have time to think it through. They have to kind of go with their guts. And so, and it's very much like in a war zone when you think about it. In a war zone, sometimes soldiers, because of the horrendous nature of the war zone, soldiers sometimes go to extremes, react. They're under extreme duress, and so they act in ways that if you're standing outside it objectively and not in the situation, you would say, well, how could they possibly behave that way? So when you recognize there's really, I think, two issues going on here. One is, maybe it's more complicated than that, but I think sort of at the root of it is, the economic imbalances, so that you have extreme poverty, which tends to breed crime, and the poverty is related to how effective or ineffective our educational systems are, how equitable distribution of wealth is. I mean, those sorts of things are all kind of part of the whole picture. And, you know, voicing your opinion on, you know, about a group doesn't really end up doing as much as looking at sort of the underlying problems and saying, you know, okay, why are these places breeding crime? Why do these places exist at all? The poverty areas and the culture of crime that tends to generate, you know, and what can we do to alleviate that? What can we do to lift people up, as opposed to just putting more and more people into jail?
So, exactly.
A deeper problem than even our sort of tendency to judge by appearances.
Well, you know, back in the day, you know, the U.S. had the policy of containment, right, as a global strategy, you know, containing the red menace, you know, of communism, if you like. And hence we, you know, I guess it went to Vietnam, you know, ostensibly to contain it and stop communism spreading. And I think we have the same, and it was obviously a failed policy, obviously didn't work very well. And when communism fell, it didn't fall because we contained it. It fell from the inside out, you know, because it was inherently unjust, I think. You know, we have this policy of containment in our society, don't we, at home here? You know, we contain problematic folks, whether they be problematic because of their class or their color. We contain them in a sort of limited area. And like you say, those areas can become very violent for the very nature that people don't like to be contained in, you know, a low economic situation. So we create almost create the problem. It's self-generated, and obviously that containment doesn't work because it's almost like the buildup of tension is going to explode from that container that we've put these folks in. So you have to really look systemically, like you said. It's not about fixing the police, for instance, and it's not about just having incentives for, you know, lower income people or for African Americans, because we've done fairly well in some areas in that regard. You know, we see that the police chiefs of Dallas and Atlanta and many other places are African American now, which is, you know, that could never have happened back in the before the 60s. Well, certainly it couldn't have happened maybe in the last 20 years. But so those are movements forward, but we really just have not addressed the systemic problems, right?
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things that sort of related to that, when I was in college, I was a sociology major, and I did some research on the idea of prison reform, and kind of digging back into what had been done regarding what's called the recidivism problem, which is a person goes to jail, then they get out, they go back to jail, and so on, repeatedly. And, you know, back in the studies of that, commissions were formed to study the problem and make recommendations, and going all the way back to, the early 1900s. And there have been a number of them in that range from the early 1900s to when I was in school in the early 70s. And every commission basically said the same thing. Which was that if we look at prisons as places to punish and we don't effectively prepare people to go back into society and be productive, if they aren't seen as institutions for rehabilitation, we'll continue to have the recidivism problem. Every commission said that, and every time the commission made the report to Congress, nothing was done about it. So it's... Yeah. You know, even sometimes when something like a solution can be seen, it still takes political will to implement it. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So and that's the nature of democracy. You know, we just kind of stumble along, and sometimes it'll take longer to get something done in a democracy than in a dictatorship. But on the other hand, when it gets done in democracy, it tends to reflect the general welfare rather than the sort of whims of the dictator. So,
right, yeah. I think most people are aware of the problem. It's just the unwillingness to find a solution that's very frustrating. I'm with Jim Gaither. We're talking about religion and violence. And it's a three-part series that I'm conducting. When we come back, we'll ask that old chestnut question, what would Jesus do? So join us in a couple of minutes to find out what Jesus would do.
Unity Online Radio brings you inspiring programs on a variety of spiritual topics. Giving to the network is now easier than ever. Simply text Unity Radio to 72727 from your smartphone. You can make a one-time or recurring donation. Your gifts help us offer enriching spiritual programs that reach listeners around the world. Text Unity Radio to 72727. Thank you for your support.
What does simple living sound like to you? Is it a quiet moment on your front porch? A cold beverage after a long day? Or maybe spending quality time with your family? Whatever it is, simple living is a powerful act of joy, abundance, and refreshment. Want to simplify your life? Join the Simple Living Challenge by Bright Peak Financial. It's an inspiring and easy 14-day challenge to help you cut down on life's clutter to lead a simpler, more balanced life. Go to simplelivingchallenge.com to sign up.
You have a coach in your corner. A life coach, that is. Like a coach in sports, a life coach can help you set clear goals and develop the confidence and tools you need to achieve them. Join certified life coach Carla McClellan Tuesdays at 3 p.m. for Vibrant Living on Unity Online Radio. Each week, Coach Carla and her guests will share strategies and solutions designed to help make your life more focused, more meaningful, and more vibrant. Do you have a specific issue or topic you'd like to discuss with Coach Carla? Call in toll-free Tuesdays at 3 p.m. during Vibrant Living, Life Coaching with Carla.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. This is part two of a three-part series we're conducting looking at religion and violence. And we posed the question before the break, what would Jesus do? You know, Jesus came to create a new paradigm, which I don't think we really, even today, have got half our heads around what he was really saying. And certainly many things have been done in the name of Jesus and the name of Christianity that don't really fit the paradigm that he was trying to bring us. And being co-opted by the forces of duality, and Jesus, in our viewpoint anyway, from a unity perspective, was certainly not a dualistic thinker. He was a unitive thinker. So he wasn't an advocate of violence in any way, was he, Jim?
No, I believe quite the opposite. By the way, Paul, I love that phrase. What is it? He was co-opted by dualists.
Yeah.
That's a succinct, succinct description of what happened historically. Okay, and sorry, now I forgot the original question.
The idea that Jesus wasn't really interested in violence. You know, many of his followers wanted him to kind of rise up, you know, and create this kingdom on earth and overthrow the Romans, but that wasn't his path.
Right, and you know, it's I've heard ministers, preachers of different faiths make much about the story of Jesus going in and turning over the tables in the temple to times to justify anger or to justify violence, and I think that very much actually misses the point of that particular incident. But in any case, you know, it's very clear that Jesus had nonviolent strategies for changing society, and his strategies are really interesting, and they were especially appropriate for his time. I mentioned earlier the idea that we have the right to peaceably assemble for, you know, the redress of grievances and that sort of thing. Well, in Jesus' time, if they tried to peaceably assemble, the odds were they would get slaughtered by Roman soldiers. I mean, that happened on a number of occasions, including when Pilate was the governor there. So that would not have been an effective strategy in his time and place. But I think clearly Jesus was about non-judgment, forgiveness, love, compassion, those sorts of things in a sort of general way. He certainly wouldn't be, I can't imagine him being objecting to the peaceable assembly kind of thing when it would work, or even civil disobedience. But his strategy was actually very suited for its time, and I think it was applied by early Christians and worked pretty well. And it's probably most simply and clearly understood by the well-known idea of going the extra mile. In order to understand that passage where Jesus said, if anybody compels you to carry a burden for a mile, go with him an extra mile, it really has to be understood in cultural context to really see what is going on there. Because, and I think most people know that, people who've heard it discussed at any rate know that saying refers to the fact that a Roman soldier could compel anyone in a Roman territory to carry part of their burden or, you know, the supplies and that sort of thing, could compel them to carry it for 1 mile. That was the law, all right? So that's part of the context. The other part of the context, and what makes the strategy powerful and effective, is that the culture was what anthropologists describe as an honor-shame culture, which basically, and you see these cultures in different periods and different places over time, but what it basically means is that everything revolved around either being honorable, and if you weren't honorable according to the customs of the place and time, then you were shamed and often sometimes shunned or even exiled by society. And in the context of the Mediterranean world of Jesus's time, one of the primary ways of forming friendships was to do someone a favor. And the idea of friendship was almost economic. The idea was if you did someone a favor, then they owed you a favor. And we still, we have some of that in our mentality now. When somebody does you a favor, you kind of feel like you want to return the favor, or you feel like you owe the favor. And
well,
so
there's even that phrase, isn't there? You owe me one, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so all you have to do to sort of understand the culture is exaggerate that a little bit and imagine if you did, you know, what it would be like for a person if in those times if they did not return the favor. People would have considered that to be dishonorable. Right, they would have considered it. That person might be shunned. They might be not trusted until they, you know, did something to show, you know, their conformity to that idea of to the trade of favors. And so, for Jesus or for one of his followers to carry a soldier's burden an extra mile beyond what they were required to do by law, would in effect be doing that person a favor, which would mean then that that person would owe them a favor in the context of that culture, right? So the in effect, if you carry the soldier's burden an extra mile, they would owe you one, as you put it. They would owe you one. And that was sort of the means of bonding and forming, you know, relationships, what we think of especially today as friendships, but it was a little bit, I want to say it's a little bit more of an economic kind of thing in a way. And so if the early Christians had, and I assume they did, had followed that, they would have been sort of had a nice strategy for making friends with the Romans. So the principle, but sort of the idea behind the strategy was basically to form bonds of friendship with people who were considered to be enemies, and to do so by doing them some sort of favor. Okay. Now, you know, some of the other sayings of Jesus related to that are a little bit trickier to understand and explain, which is why I chose this particular one. But that's kind of the idea, to get, for one thing, to, you know, get that sort of obligation in place to establish that bond, but also to raise the person in the sight of the, if you will, of the oppressor or the enemy, to raise them up, to see, to be seen as, in effect, an equal. Okay, so there's this sort of a shift of the ideas, shifting the status. So, and I think that sort of approach is could still be applicable today in various contexts. If you really want to change a relationship with someone you see as an oppressor or as an adversary of some kind. A way to do that would be to treat them as if they were a friend, and as if you were, you know, as if you were glad to, you know, treat them as such. And eventually, I think that would, you know, transform the relationship from the other side as well.
Yes.
Not necessarily that that would be an easy thing, and probably it may it might require persistence in certain cases. But I mean, it gives you a sense of okay, this is the. This is a strategy for attaining a certain kind of relationship. And I don't know exactly how you would end up or could end up applying that to some of our current situations, but I think to some degree police departments, we're going back to that, police departments are trying to do that by, you know, being present in neighborhoods as something other than someone who handcuffs people. Or shoots them, so they're as, you know, to interact with the community in friendly ways. I think that's, you know, I think that's sort of a positive and kind of modern modern application of the basic idea.
Well, I think it's also, you know, moving beyond the transaction, moving beyond the even exchange, the agreement that's been made societally, you know, moving it into a more expansive place, too. There's another interpretation that sort of goes along with what you're saying. It's refusing to take it at the level that it's that it's showing up as, you know, there's a requirement, I think, to do that. The police are going to have to look at themselves in a more honest and expansive way and see that, you know, it's not always the way they think it is. And likewise, from the other side, you know, the idea that there could be an extension, and I've seen that actually. There's been some amazing YouTubes, and I think there's a black country music singer named Coffee Anderson whose video about how to be safe, you know, when you're stopped by the police, has gone viral. It has like 40 million hits, I think. But you know, this is to me is an example of going the extra mile. You know, instead of saying, "Well, I'm really furious at the police." Well, let's look at it, you know, let's neutralize it and see how we can do something that will allow the police not to go there in the first place. So, you know, expanding into something new. Another view on that, you know, the second mile is it subverts, doesn't it? You know, if the Romans were expected to lord it over the people of Palestine, for instance, it failed, you know, because once you've got the obligation of having to be a friend to someone, you know, how can you rule so effectively? So
Jesus, right. It's very subversive. Yeah, very subversive.
Subversive, yeah.
And you know, I think you started to get into something that I think is very important, which is that the you know, we look at the strategies or what sort of are the outcomes, we kind of miss, again, if we just look at that, we kind of miss the deeper point. And the deeper point, as you know, Paul, is about consciousness. So it's, you know, just as those ideas came out of Jesus' consciousness, there's a consciousness behind them and a consciousness in spiritual terms that, you know, we're seeking, which is that consciousness of compassion, of, I want to say, empathy, the ability to see, to feel, and to understand another person's, other people's perspectives, when even though they may be very different than yours, to be able to relate to them and then see that person more deeply than the differences to the common humanity and, as we would say, you know, in spiritual terms, the common divinity that's in that person.
Right.
Yeah, and I mean that's ultimately what it's all about. And of course, in unity, that's the thing we primarily emphasize, is changing consciousness, because we do believe that as consciousness changes, outer circumstances are transformed. And part of, you know, indicator of changed consciousness, of course, is changes in consciousness are how we speak and how we act, and the kinds of things we say and the tone in which all of that, you know, the consciousness comes out in those outer actions and words. And that's where the, you know, I think there's probably people who, maybe a lot of people who are involved in movements like Black Lives Matter and other, you know, various organizations that are trying to change society, that behind their actions, whether even if their actions just carrying a sign, behind that is a deeper, you know, the deeper consciousness, the spirituality. It's how they express their spirituality. It's not necessarily the only way to do it. I wouldn't say it is the only way, but I think that's, you know, that's sort of what we're aiming for, is not just that what the outer picture looks like, but also that, you know, that change at a deeper level.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what would Jesus do then in this circumstance that we're facing ourselves with in modern-day America? You know, the election season, Trump and Hillary, violence, and war zones in the Middle East still, you know, and the threats of worse terror coming to us. What would he be counseling?
I don't think his counsel would, in terms of the principles, I don't think that would change. I think certainly the way he expressed them would change, because our forms of communication and education are different now. So it would certainly be interesting to see what he would make of modern technology and the possibility of reaching people with through various media, and also, you know, addressing our consciousness in our culture. So I think, you know, to say, well, what would he do? It would be interesting to know. I don't really know. I think that what I do believe is that whatever he did, however he used that medium, however he addressed modern culture, what kinds of words he used, would be still rooted in that consciousness of empathy and understanding, forgiveness, non-judgment, and going through the world in that way, counseling that. And I like to think he would also have come up, he also would come up with some new and really powerful strategies, as he did in his own time, or tactics, if you will, to implement that.
He might have used YouTube, is that what you're saying? Or he could have tweeted.
He might very well use YouTube. I mean, there's an element of Jesus' style in his own time that he was, you know, he was an entertainer. People would, he was a storyteller. And people would flock to good storytellers. And Jesus' stories were really unusual, even in the context of his time. He was, you know, probably the closest comparison in the ancient world would be somebody like Aesop, you know, who would tell these little stories, and people would wonder about sort of what they would mean, but they could maybe see the specific applications. But fundamentally, they listened to him because his stories were entertaining; they were interesting. I even saw a passage once, Paul, and you're probably familiar with this book. It's called The Gospel of Buddha. It's kind of an older collection of the sayings of Buddha, and in that selection of texts, there's a place where a Buddha is sort of contemplating, well, how shall I deliver my message? And he says to himself, people are like children. They love to be entertained. Therefore, I will tell them stories. And the Buddha had told a number of parables. And I always thought that was, you know, if he didn't actually say that, it was a really insightful thing to say about his perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Was that the Paul Karras book, right?
Yes.
Yeah, good book. The, you know, and Jesus himself says, you know, I'm not going to tell you the deeper secrets. You know, everything will be in parables, and there's great power. I mean, it's like why we want to watch TV and go to movies. I think is the story that inspires us, isn't it? And I think you know, we can dream a new story. You know, we talk about stories sometimes in a negative sense. You know, holding on to your story about yourself, but you can also look at it in a larger sense, right? Creating a new possibility, a new, like we talk about the American dream, which is really the American story dreamt into being. You know, it's a very Native American idea. And, you know, there's no reason why we can't dream a new dream. And I think, you know,
I love that idea. Yeah.
Yeah. I think our president has encouraged us in that. You know, Obama talks about we're not limited except by what we've, you know, accepted from the past, and we don't have to accept all of it. You know, much of it has been great, but there's other parts of it that we can reimagine and consider again. And I think this is potent stuff. When it's potent when we hear these spiritual principles coming from, you know, high political office, I think, and people daring to have that kind of rhetoric. I know some people dismiss it as, well, he's a great wordsmith or whatever. But you know, you can dismiss anything. You know, I'm sure Jesus was a great wordsmith too. But, you know, if that's all you can see in the person, then you miss the deeper impact of what they have to say. So I think there is this possibility, isn't there? I know a number of people in New Thought circles have said recently, oh, you know, the breaking down, it's like the phoenix, you know, the will arise from the ashes. The terror and the horror is part of the breaking through to new understanding. And then I think that's true to a degree, though. I think it's kind of easy to go there, isn't it? It's nice to say, you know, but it doesn't seem quite so nice when we're dealing day after day with terroristic situations.
Right. And that's a thing that could have been said in any era. You can always round and find, you know, find the aberrations, you know, and that's the thing I think a lot, you know, from my perspective, for example, on the news is what the news shows us are the aberrations. It doesn't show us the everyday because it's not interesting because everybody lives in the everyday.
Yeah.
So, you know what I'm saying? The aberrations are the things that are unusual enough that they are reported on. Dog bites man is not news. Man bites dog is news, kind of thing. And so, you know, there's that sort of element. We're more exposed.
It's a good chestnut, that one. I like that one.
We're exposed to things more quickly. But, you know, when you're talking about the changing the story, it occurred to me that, you know, the whole people becoming more and more conscious of what Joseph Campbell and others have called the hero's journey. America's story, story of itself, is kind of like a Horatio Alger tale, where the person becomes successful, and by what's meant by success is that, well, they become the, you know, a business person who you know, who is rich and powerful, or a political leader who's rich and powerful. But if you read the hero's journey, as people become conscious of that, it's a journey into spiritual enlightenment. If that became America's story, America would be moving would be dreaming a different dream and moving in a different direction. And I think I see signs of that happening. You know, I mean, it's not pervasive, but it's more pervasive than it has been in the past. The sort of the idea of the hero's journey as a spiritual quest, rather than the hero's journey, as in American terms, as a quest for wealth, you know, real basic way. I mean, it doesn't mean you can't have wealth, or that won't be part of your journey. But that's not sort of not the point of the journey, and what becomes respected and admired is not so much having great wealth, but having to use our terminology again, having great consciousness, having spiritual consciousness and wisdom and compassion and those sorts of things. So, you know, that story could be shifting now, and I'm hoping that it is. And I think that your program contributes to that. So
yeah, well, hopefully, you know, many things are contributing to it, and thank you for that. You know, we talk about tipping points, don't we? You know, that it only takes a certain amount of people to think a new thought that before everybody's talking about it. You know, and that's a lovely idea that you know, if we keep pushing these ideas of expansiveness and compassion and possibility, that eventually, you know, it's gonna become a reality. I think it's already a reality personally, because I see amazing things happen on a daily basis, and they're not newsworthy because they're not aberrational, but they truly are wonderful. And I like it when the news does occasionally focus on
the good,
right?
Yeah.
When we take time to look at some of the wonders of our world and the ingenuity of the human species, you know, not just its craziness. Though I probably today, man bites dog would not be news. You know, there's so many.
Yeah, that's true. It's a rather old journalistic saying.
That's right. Yeah.
You might be right. It's probably not.
Yeah, whatever. You know. We got bigger fish to fry than that.
Right.
Yeah. So, are all religions violent? Has there ever been a non-violent religion?
There has never been a religion that had only nonviolent people in it, is the way I know.
There we go.
You know, there are, you know, if you look at what the moral and spiritual aspirations are of religions, any of them, it's not fundamentally about getting people to conform to a certain belief system. It's what's underneath, or what's the sort of the high moral aspirations are, you know, a friendship, wisdom, justice, mercy, compassion. All of them have those elements as sort of their highest aspirations, and most of them, at least, have stories that are sort of you know, folk tale. If you look in the Hebrew scriptures, you have the various stories of wars and all kinds of things that don't necessarily reflect the highest moral aspirations that you will find in those scriptures. And the same thing is true, you know, if you read the Quran or, you know, even the Bhagavad Gita, as beautiful and spiritual a book as it is in many ways, it's fundamentally about a war, you know, or at least at the surface, it's about a war. So, you know, you mentioned at the top of the program that there, you know, people may be, it may be sort of biologically ingrained in us to be violent, and you know, that may actually be part of you know, the survival of the species in terms of evolution. But evolution,
right,
means change, so you know, it may becoming something more like, well, having understanding, having wisdom, having compassion are what's most important for the survival of the individual and of the species. And when that evolution occurs, you're going to see something very different. But, you know, like you say, you know, you can, in any group's, in any religion's background, you can find violence. But I don't think it really, and in any of those cases, reflects the sort of highest thought and the highest wisdom and spiritual aspirations of any of those religions. I think it's a byproduct of human beings being involved.
Yeah, and I guess Christianity is a good case in point, because, you know, it was founded, well, it wasn't actually founded, but, you know, we consider him to be the beginning of it, Jesus himself, you know, was a person, as we just discussed, you know, not in any way bound by those old ways of conditioned response to defensiveness and anger and frustration with others, and yet you know, what's been done in the name of Jesus, of course, is famous, isn't it, as being extremely violent at times, and whether it's the Inquisition or the Crusades or a million other things that have happened that have been less than Christ-like. But we can't blame Jesus for this. It's our own lack of being able to go to a deeper level of understanding. I've always thought that Buddhism had done best, of all the religions, of being nonviolent. But even Buddhism, has at times failed and been kind of ugly for people with the case in Japan in the 17th century where Christians were tortured in great numbers, and of course it wasn't necessarily by the Buddhist society but by the shoguns and those that controlled that society. So again, it may not just be the religions to blame, but the way it was practiced. So what's the next step? We have a couple of minutes left in the show. If you could give us one iota of comfort today, Jim, what would it be?
For some reason today I was thinking about the whole, and maybe it's because I knew I was going to be on your program, but I was thinking about the whole notion of our times and other times, and whether things are going downhill or whether they're going uphill. And whenever I think about that, because I don't really consider myself an historical scholar, but I am someone who's very sort of interested in history and have read a lot about history. And what I can tell you is that there isn't any previous time that I would prefer to live in than ours. Or place, because when I look at any given era, I see things that I say, "Oh, well, we've moved beyond that." And you don't even have to go back very far. We've moved beyond blatant legalized segregation in this country, as an example, right? I wouldn't particularly want to live, although I did live during the segregation era, but I don't think that's a better time. So there are things that could be improved, but there are also ways in which we have made tremendous progress. You think of one of my heroes, the transcendentalist grouping, was Thoreau. And Thoreau, wrote that wonderful book on civil disobedience, and he was willing to go to jail for his beliefs. And what's happened, at his time, people just thought he was, sort of obnoxious and, almost criminal. That would have been the society's estimation of him. But now we think of civil disobedience as being something that is noble and morally appropriate for changing injustices in society. So, that's another example of moral progress. What people thought of Thoreau in his time, or actually probably even go back to Gandhi or Dr. King, what people thought of them at the time and how people have shifted off of that perspective into seeing something more noble in it, something higher in those protests and those ways of peaceful protest. So, yeah, I'd say I think that's a bit of comfort and hope, is that things have gotten better from in a lot of ways from previous eras. So
right. Well, and just the luxury we live in, every plug we have in our house is six servants, I think they say. So if you've got 20 plugs in your house, you now have a couple of hundred servants.
I don't think I've heard that, but that's good.
Only kings had that kind of stuff. Now everybody has it. And even the poorest of us, have servants in that sense. And so we always got to look at it in the context of we take things for granted. We're creatures of our age, but there are wonders all around us. Maybe that's a good way to end the show, because we are out of time.
We live in an age of electronic miracles.
Here we go. Before I say goodbye to Jim, next week I want to tell you about our third part in the series. I've invited John Hightower to join me. He knows a lot about A Course in Miracles, and so we're going to look at religion and violence through that lens, through the lens of Course in Miracles. And he's also a therapist, so we'll look at some other aspects too. So join us for our third part of the series next week. Thanks, Jim. It's always a joy to have you on the show with me.
It's always a joy to be here, Paul. Thank you for inviting me again.
And thank you, folks, for listening. We appreciate your support. All right, have a good week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
You know the saying, a good deed is its own reward? Well, moving toward a plant-based diet and vegan lifestyle is one kind and compassionate act that isn't just its own reward. It will also reward you with vibrant health, boundless energy, an easy way to keep your weight where you want it, and according to yogis and Unity's co-founder Charles Fillmore, even give a boost to your spiritual life. On Main Street Vegan, the radio program named for the popular book, Victoria Moran will make your move in a vegan direction easy, fun, affordable, and delicious. With enticing topics and entertaining guests every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Central Time, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Life is a balancing act with hectic schedules and ceaseless demands on our time and attention. We've learned to prioritize. So often, though, I neglect to make time for what is most important. In our drive to get things done, there is an underlying desire, a need we all share, the need for peace. It is a gift that waits within me, ready to be enjoyed if I will simply allow myself the opportunity to connect. Inner peace lessens the everyday stresses of life and reminds me that how I am, the mental and spiritual point from which I view myself, is as important as what I do. I can make peace a priority. Peace can begin with me.
To find a Unity Church near you, please visit our website at www.unity.org.
Have you ever considered that everything you think, say, and do is a prayer to the universe? What would your life be like if you activated the power of yes? Join Reverend Beverly Molander and her exciting guests on Affirmative Prayer, Activating the Power of Yes, to find out how they activated the power of yes in their lives, their communities, or even the world. If they can do it, you can too. Listen to Beverly Molander and her guests live every Monday at noon Central, 1 p.m. Eastern, on Affirmative Prayer, Activating the Power of Yes, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Today's episode has been made possible through the generous support of Bright Peak Financial, an award-winning, not-for-profit supporting Christians on their journey to financial strength. Go to brightpeakfinancial.com to make your dream happen.
You know the saying, a good deed is its own reward? Well, moving toward a plant-based diet and vegan lifestyle is one kind and compassionate act that isn't just its own reward. It will also reward you with vibrant health, boundless energy, an easy way to keep your weight where you want it, and according to Yogi's and Unity's co-founder Charles Fillmore, even give a boost to your spiritual life. On Main Street Vegan, the radio program named for the popular book, Victoria Moran will make your move in a vegan direction easy, fun, affordable, and delicious. With enticing topics and entertaining guests every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Central Time, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.